WEBFF, you're always sounding the alarm. You always say that you're sort of the prophet of doom and gloom, and you've got even more for us today.
Well, I'm sorry to play that role. Unfortunately, we have to speak up, I think, when we see things that are of concern to us.
Fox Radio, you're on the Commons. I'm Sue Bartholomew. And joining me on the Commons today, I'm glad to have Tyler Birding back with us. Tyler, thank you.
In this industry, with community associations, I think there's a lot that isn't recognized and, by owners and boards and really needs to be.
Well, one of the things that, and yesterday when I called you, we talked a little bit about whether it's a contract or a government or a quasi-government or what on earth are associations. But before we get into that, let's talk a little bit about you. You're an attorney in California. You've had about 30 years experience representing associations, right?
That's right. Our law firm is basically specialized around the legal problems of community associations.
The legal problems, and you said you're busy.
Well, we are, and I, in the sense that, you know, community association issues don't stop with changes in the economy, and sometimes they get worse. So there's a lot of need to for counseling and a lot of need for assistance.
You recently wrote a paper about whether associations were contractual relationships, or exactly what they were. And yesterday when we were talking a little bit, you said that people don't know what they're getting into. Tell us what an HOA is.
Well, there's a lot of misperception about what the entity really is. A lot of owners, and I see this all the time at board meetings and other places where owners will come and ask questions, that somehow they liken a community association to some kind of branch of local government, that it's like a city council or it has bureaucrats working for it, and that it somehow they believe that the government has some sort of influence over community associations. And actually, that's completely untrue. A community association is completely contractual in nature. It's based on a common law of contract. It is an agreement, essentially, among the owners of the property to govern themselves in a certain way and to impose certain restrictions on the property that they own. And the government really has nothing to do with that other than the fact that there are statutes in California, of course, elsewhere in the nation, that provide certain regulation of community associations, but they aren't the basis for the organization itself. It's really based on contract.
Well, the contract aspect of it seems to come in from the standpoint that CC&Is are recorded in the land records, and that by being available, they form the basis for a for constructive notice that any buyer has got to go in and do their due diligence and find the governing documents, read the governing documents, and by buying into the association are deemed to agree with the contents. Is that correct? Is that where the contract comes in?
Well, it comes in several ways, but that's certainly one of them. CC&R stands for Conditions, Covenants, and Restrictions. And a covenant, of course, is the basic element of a contract. And they are recorded, and they're recorded so that, as lawyers refer to them, they run with the land. That means they are permanently imposed on the property, and they move from buyer to buyer. The obligation moves from buyer to buyer. As sales take place, the essential contract continues in place, and by buying in, you are, yes, acknowledging that you will abide by the terms and conditions of that contract, just like any transaction, commercial transaction that you'd enter into.
Well, I had a real estate license, and of course I had to go and take all the classes. And one of the, you're talking about buyer, from buyer to buyer. One of the things that I remember being taught in that class was that in order to have a contract, there has to be a meeting of the minds. Otherwise, you don't have a valid contract, right?
That's correct.
Is there a meeting of the minds here in an association?
Well, you have to ask yourself, is there a legal meeting of the minds or is there an actual meeting of the minds? And those two things may be very different in a typical community association transaction. A legal meeting of the minds simply means that on paper, on the documents signed by each of the parties, they have expressed an agreement in a way that a court will recognize. That's a legal meeting of the minds, meaning are all the terms and conditions there that are supposed to be there on the paper, and did they sign it? Whether they really knew what they were signing, though, is really the question, and probably the reason that a lot of us write the articles we write, because people don't understand necessarily what they're getting into. And the contract itself is not a single document. It's an accumulation of documents that will include the CC&Rs, but also include the purchase and sale agreement that you sign on to, which is also a contract in its own right. There are other governing documents that are incorporated into the transaction, the bylaws, the house rules, and things like that. But all of that taken together constitutes a contractual agreement that has to satisfy the requirement that you said. There has to be a legal meeting of the minds. But that begs the question of whether people really understand what they're getting into.
How do we remedy that? I mean, Tyler, we've been talking about education for the last 40 years. We're going to educate people. We're going to educate boards. We're going to educate buyers. With all the education, people still don't know what they're getting into.
Well, that's why a lot of us write articles that choke the web pages. we're trying. You know, we're trying to explain to people. But I have to tell you, there's a lot of ambivalence there among owners. I know there's concern, but I also note, because we go to these board meetings, we meet with boards of directors, we talk to the owners who come there to listen, very, very few owners avail themselves of the opportunity to know what's going on in their own community association. If you get three or four owners at a typical board meeting, that's a lot in a 100-unit project. The people just either, I'm not saying they don't care, but they got so many other things going on in their lives, association matters are way down on the list.
But, Tyler, they've been sold carefree living. You know, that's the whole premise of buying into these voluntarily is that I don't have to take care of anything. I don't have to be involved. Someone else is going to do it, and that's what they're sold, and that's what they're buying into.
Well,
and then they come in and say, hey, you've got to sit on the board, you've got to attend meetings, you've got to be, you know, you've got to get involved in this.
Well, they do think that, but the fact is it's not true. That's, you know, it's not true that you can just surrender all of your rights, I mean, all of the obligations to someone else and just enjoy the rights. It's just, you have to, A, you have to understand what you've gotten into, B, you've got to be ready to write the checks necessary to meet those obligations. And C, you have to educate yourself as to what the board is doing. You can surrender your involvement, you surrender your rights to the board completely if you want to. The problem is people don't really think that's what they're doing, and when things don't go quite the way they think they should, then they'll come to board meetings and complain. But one of the bigger problems we have in community associations, we can't get people to serve on the board of directors.
We're going to be talking about that quite a bit in a little bit, but I want to continue with this. But before we go anywhere else, Tyler, tell us about, you've got two excellent websites with some really scary, horrible pictures on them. you want to give us the URLs, you've got your blog and the website?
Yeah, the firm's website is Berding-Weil, that's Berding-Weil, Weil.com. And it has a lot of articles. We have a library there that anybody can go into and read the articles that are there. There's been, you know, about 5-10 years accumulation of pertinent articles. That's one. And then the other one is my blog, which is condoissues.com. And that is a series of articles that I've written. And, yes, I've illustrated them with various scary pictures, if you will, things that you do see in some cases around. Some of the buildings are in pretty bad shape.
The buildings on the firm's website, you know, I don't know that anybody wants to go home to those. They're scary.
Unfortunately, they do, and they have to, and they've gotten that way because we've, you know, deferred an awful lot of maintenance in these projects that should have been done, but for reasons, one reason or the other, mostly economic, aren't done when they should be.
They're kind of scary. Well, go check out those websites because there is a lot of good information, and there's a lot of scary pictures. And on the blog, one of them, you've got a woman nailing a coffin, nailing a nail in the coffin. But that's the one we're going to talk about in a little bit. But Tyler, how do we educate people? How do we let people know exactly what they're getting into?
Well, I think it starts at the very basic level with the board of directors. And believe me, board members have an awful lot on their plates of things they have to do right now. But between the board members themselves and management, it's really important that a couple times a year you have a town hall meeting and you get as many owners as possible to come. And you really explain to them the issues as best you can that are affecting the association and what the concerns are that the board has about all of those. The annual meeting where you elect directors is important, and a lot of people will come out to that. That's a good opportunity for that kind of town hall meeting. And I would do it once or twice two or three additional times during a year because you want to get as many homeowners as possible involved in the discussion. The biggest concern that homeowners express is, well, the board just making these decisions on its own, and we don't know what's going on. And really, the board isn't intending to do that, but there has to be an opportunity to educate, and I think one of the best ways is to have these meetings where you can bring in some of the professionals. You bring in the manager, they explain what they're doing. You can bring in legal counsel. They can explain any of the legal issues that are involved with. The accountant can come in and talk about the budget a little bit. The reserve study people. You can bring people in and have a presentation to owners, and owners appreciate that. They'll ask questions, and that goes a long way to educating them.
That's opening up things and being a little more transparent, and I agree with you, but isn't that a little too late? Shouldn't people know about what they're getting into before they get into it?
Well, that brings us back to the interface between government and these contractual entities. Governments provide in various states a set of statutes that developers have to follow in order to incorporate and create a community association. And when they sell an interest in one, there are certain disclosure obligations that they have. In California, that's done by the California Department of Real Estate. The problem with it is it is very perfunctory, and the kind of disclosures that are made at the time of sale just do not educate people as to the nature of the entity they're involved in. Now, a lot of people have lived in other community associations, and they know, because from their own experience, what they're into, but an awful lot of people are first-time buyers, or they've moved out of a big single-family home that they've lived in for 25, 30 years, and now they're going to live in a community association. So a lot of them are first-timers, and they don't understand, and the state departments that allow these communities to be created need to do a better job in the beginning acquainting people with what it is they're buying into, and I don't see that happening.
Well, when I suggested that we put it all down, I mean, if it's such a great concept and it's a great idea and all of that, let's put down all the pitfalls, all the what you're getting into. And I was looked at with absolute horror. My God, nobody would buy into one of these things if you told them what they were getting into.
Well, that's another part of the problem. You can educate people as to their essential nature. You can show them the budget. But what we found is that, especially in the older ones, they have not been investigated sufficiently so that the budgets truly reflect what the ongoing cost of repairs actually is going to be. And it is a it is one of the biggest problems that we've written about quite a lot, that if they don't know, if the management doesn't know, if the board doesn't know, there's no way they can educate the owners. And a lot of that is just failing to investigate adequately components that may not be all that visible in order to establish an adequate budget. And I do believe that an awful lot of people don't know what they're getting into because nobody does. Nobody has done the necessary investigation.
And the thing is, in a lot of places, I don't know about your particular area in California, but I know where I live, over 90% of all housing is in an association, and we've had mandates in Fairfax County since the early 80s. So 100% of everything that's been built recently is in an association, so there is no option.
Yes.
The option is to be a renter, a tenant, or an owner.
That's true, and it's going to be more so that way as we focus on increasing density in cities and not spreading out into the suburbs. And so it's more and more important all the time that people understand that the streets and the landscaping and the structures in these communities are not going to be maintained by local government. They're not going to be paid for with your property taxes. That's going elsewhere to pay for other things outside of your community. Everything inside the gates of that community or inside the fences of that community are the owner's responsibility, and while they look a lot like things that the city maintains, they're not.
So if the government is sort of shunting off all of their responsibilities onto the private sector, isn't it an arm of the government? Doesn't it become an arm of the government? I'm just playing devil's advocate here in terms of the actual contractual nature of associations. I know the legal foundation is there, but the reality is a little different.
Actually, I wish it were true, and here's why. If we have in California several cities now that have gone into bankruptcy because of this economy, if those cities fail to operate because they don't have adequate funds, they don't disappear, or their obligations don't disappear. They're picked up by perhaps the county in which they exist. If a county were to fail, a state, its obligations wouldn't just stop being taken care of. The state would have to step in and absorb that responsibility. In other words, there's a series of safety nets that if there is failure at a lower level, there's somebody bigger behind it to pick it up. That's not true in a community association. There's no safety net. The city will not come in and start painting your buildings or paving your streets. The county won't come in and do that if you live in a county and not in an incorporated city. There is no safety net. That is one of the biggest differences between community associations and true public entities. In public entities, there's always the public safety net of some sort. Not so with community associations. So failure is a much more critical issue with community associations.
We're talking to Tyler Birding. Tyler is an attorney in California with the firm of Birding Weil, is it? And he's a prolific author. He's got a blog and a lot of good articles on his website, and check them out. I have links on my website, and I'll put some in the promos as well. So, you know, go to the website and look at it, because Tyler does talk about a lot of problems that keep coming up in associations. Tyler, how do your colleagues view some of the stuff that you write? Are they upset with you?
Yeah, they think I'm scaring all the clients away. No, not really. They all recognize the problem. I have calls from other lawyers all the time, you know, talking about the articles that I write and some of these things. I have to tell you, in all my travels around our industry, I've never had anyone step up to me and say, "You're wrong, Tyler. This isn't going to happen. These community associations are going to survive just fine on their own. There's nothing to worry about." Everyone agrees. I mean, this is a problem that is not mine, my own creation. I mean, it clearly exists out there, and the future of these entities are in doubt. And there, you know, my colleagues all feel the same way.
Well, it's funny because when I talk to them one-on-one off the air, they agree with you and they agree with me. But when it comes to getting on the air and talking about it, it's a whole different story. Well, sure, I didn't really mean that.
Well, I hope I'm consistent between what I write and what I say. And
you are.
It is a problem that, now, here's one reason why there's a little waffling on things like this. It isn't happening right now in every association. It's degrees of concern that you'll have depending on how well these associations have been maintained, how well they've provided adequately in their budgets. And, of course, there's so many different scenarios there. And the problem is insidious. It's going to happen over a longer period of time. We're beginning to see it a lot in 25, 30, 35-year-old communities that are beginning to determine that they need repairs that nobody ever budgeted for. And that can only go on for so long. And with this wave of condominium conversions that we've had over the last 2 or 3 years, it's especially pronounced, because when you take an old apartment house and you turn it over to people who were formerly renters and you sell these units to them, and now you tell them they're responsible for all this maintenance. Most apartment houses weren't all that well maintained over time. All that deferred maintenance is now passed off to these owners with probably not a budget adequate to deal with it. So it's an insidious long-term problem, not one that you would get by, something collapsed. Oh, my God, these whole complexes has failed, like you'd have in an earthquake or a fire. This is long-term.
You have, I mean, you're talking predominantly about condominiums, and you raised the alarm about these conversions some time ago. In fact, you came on and talked about those. And I said, well, I remember saying to you, well, the nice thing is that in a declining market, that's going to reverse itself because nobody's going to be buying them.
And that's true. And that's exactly what happened. And the conversions are always the tail end of a housing boom. I've seen it 3 times in my career.
Mm-hmm.
We've had a big run-up in housing, new
right.
housing prices,
right.
and developers run out of things to sell because everything's selling so fast, so they begin casting around for other ways to produce housing quickly for sale, and apartment houses are always the candidate. And they always come at the tail end of the boom, and then they stop when the boom falls off, and I don't think you're going to see any more conversions of any quantity for a number of years.
Well, you know what we're seeing right now here? In fact, the studio's in an area that is being redeveloped. And a developer put up 2 huge towers of, they were supposed to be condominiums, and they weren't selling. So he converted the condominiums, from what I understand, into rentals.
He probably hasn't converted them legally. They are probably still condominiums. He's just renting them instead of selling them.
Right.
And that can happen. I have a lot of conversion projects that were built as condominiums 20 years ago and never sold, and now they begin to sell them. I don't think it changes the problem any. It's just a legal distinction, but that can happen. And, of course, anybody who builds a condominium complex can rent it if he chose to do it. And, frankly, I think more of them should. But
the economic factors aside, and those are huge right now because of the general economic condition of the country, but what about the quality of life issues in an association? And that's both condominiums and homeowner associations, not just the high-rises.
Well, I think, it has been impacted to some degree, although I think the people that are living in these projects and these associations are still gaining the benefits of what this whole idea is about, community living with a lot of the things taken care of professionally if they have good professional management. So I think some of the quality of life issues, most of them, that people went into buy them in the first place, led them to buy them in the first place, are still there. I have a project here in the San Francisco Bay Area that is right on the Bay Shore, and it's beautiful, and it sits and looks out over a yacht harbor, and you would look at it and you'd say, oh my God, what a wonderful place to live, and it is. It was a tremendous idea, a good concept, but it has unbelievable amounts of problems going on with it. It's sinking into the bay.
Oh, lovely.
There is, at high tides, when they have a big storm, the common areas flood. This has all been happening, over the last 10 years as this project aged. And so the quality of life in between these events is just fine. But this stuff's creeping up on them, and eventually it's going to impact them badly.
So what's that going to do to the value of their property? It's going to sink into the bay as well, right?
Yes, because all of these, that's the problem. And the quality of life was the question you asked. The quality of their investment, however, is taking a nosedive.
What about the governance issues? I hear from a lot of people about the heavy-handedness of the board, the foreclosures that the board's making, the pettiness of living in an association.
Yeah. I mean, that's a problem. You have governance by volunteers, and they are not always trained to do what they do. A lot of them, frankly, are taking these jobs as because they're people that no one else will do it. They were reluctant to come into the position in the first place. They know there are rules which they must follow as board members, and there are. And when people aren't paying their assessments, there are not a lot of good alternatives. Either they pay them or the association goes broke. And in these days, with the foreclosure rates up as high as they are, that's what gets all the press. What's not seen is that for every place that's being foreclosed, they're also not paying their homeowner dues. And that means that all the rest of the owners are paying those assessments for them. So the job of the board of directors of these community associations is getting tougher and tougher all the time, and I don't envy them, and I understand, and I feel badly for those people that have had to struggle with this. And I'll tell you, there's some stalwarts out there who are doing a heck of a job and putting in an awful lot of time, but it's not widely appreciated by the vast majority of owners because they don't understand what the nature of what they're doing.
Well, some of them are. Some of them, you have board members who are entrenched and they've been on the board for years and they won't get off and they won't leave and they don't want to leave and they just kind of are on a power trip. So you've got the gamut. You've got on both sides. You've got good people. And probably one of the most heartbreaking stories I remember reading about was about 12 years ago, I believe it was in Washington State, or Oregon, someplace over there, a woman wrote into a message board that was widely used at the time saying she and her friend walked into the annual meeting for the first time. And when they walked in, they found the board had all left. The only person at the meeting was the attorney. They were the only two homeowners who showed up. The attorney said, "Thank God you're here." He says, "You're now on the board," and turned over everything to them and left. And she was really struggling. She says, we're trying to do what's right, and nobody is interested. And that takes me to the fact that maybe people don't really want these associations.
Well, I think they want the lifestyle, and I think they like the housing style. It is very efficient way to live, and you don't have a big yard to maintain, at least you not personally. There's a lot of attractions. But the governance of them is becoming more and more difficult. And I do believe that we're going to have to look for some alternative ways to govern this housing type in the years to come. And I think we may very well have to incorporate some public entity types of, some public entity types of governance into these community associations, like special districts, where maybe we group a large number of community associations together and incorporate a special district that has taxing power and can put some professional management over that whole district and run these associations a little more like cities and counties. I'm not saying that that has a lot to recommend it either. I mean, there's plenty of problems with local government, but the volunteer corporate style of governance is having some serious problems, not the least of which is getting volunteers.
You and that's the other article that you wrote, and is that the one with the lady hammering a nail in a coffin? Why won't they serve?
Yeah, the title of the article is "Why Won't They Serve?" And it basically, why can't we get volunteers to take these board positions? Much like the example you gave a moment ago is a perfect example, and that's far more prevalent than you might imagine. They cannot fill these board positions with enough volunteers, and there's any number of reasons why that's true. And as we said in the article, you know, basically there's either a lot of homeowners just aren't aware of the fact that these associations have a certain requirement for volunteer help to keep them running. They feel that they just pay their assessments and that's all they really care about. They're really not aware of all the things that go on. And that's part of that education process we talked about. Another reason is the one everyone would understand. I don't have time to do this. I don't have time to volunteer. I've got all these other family and job obligations. I don't have time to sit on a board of directors and have to, you know, spend my time at meetings and trying to figure out budgets and things like that. I mean, so there are any number of reasons. There's the fear of the responsibility. There's people who, you know, say, wow, I don't want to be on this board because I'll have all these obligations, and if I don't do it right, somebody will, you know, take issue with that. Maybe they'll sue me. You know, there's that reason. There's the whole idea that owners will look at board members as, again, a bureaucrat, as they would look at a bureaucrat, and not realize that it's just their neighbor volunteering for a job, and challenge them. And my point in the article was, sure, challenge them. But if you want to really challenge them, run for election in the next election and get yourself on the board. You know, if they're not doing a good job, if you feel they're not doing an adequate job, the best challenge is to run for their position. That's what democracy is all about. So that's another reason that board members don't want to serve, because they don't want that tension. And then the last one is, people don't like to be somebody else's landlord. You know, in an apartment complex, we have a landlord puts out the certain rules, no satellite dishes on the balcony, you park your car head into the parking garage, you know, those kind of normal things. Most tenants have, you know, no issue with the landlord doing that. But for some reason, similar restrictions placed on neighbors by other neighbors gender a lot of animosity. And people don't want to be their neighbor's landlord and have to enforce the rules.
Well, I think there's the concept of ownership. I own this property. This is my home. I don't want you telling me what color my front door can be, how heavy my dog can be, and whether my roof needs to be dusted. And those are some of the petty, petty things that we hear about. You've empowered a neighbor to bully and boss another neighbor. And I think that's where you've created a division of them against us, in a situation where you don't have the power and you're just neighbors. You work together and you solve the issues.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think we have something about home ownership strikes in a totally different chord in the mind of the owner than, say, renting an apartment, which, frankly, the ownership interests during the period of the lease are identical. You get to use that piece of property as you see fit, as long as you abide by the rules. Not different than buying a separate interest. The difference is you buy it permanently. You don't just rent it for a year or two.
But you don't build equity in a rental. It belongs to someone else.
Well, that's true, and there is the idea that you're going to gain equity over time if you own this. And, yes, there's the whole investment aspect of it that I believe empowers people to believe they have, their rights should be intruded on less than if they were a renter. But the fact is that in order to have high-density housing with common facilities, you have to have greater rules than apply to people that own single-family detached homes. That's just a fact. But yet the attitude that a lot of owners exhibit toward the governance is very similar to if they owned a single-family detached home. They don't. They have community, an interest in a community that needs to have certain rules and regulations in order to function, but it's not widely appreciated.
But you have the same tensions in an HOA. I live in an HOA. I don't live in a high-rise. And you still have the same tensions that you have. And I think what you said, you know, in a situation of high density. So I think when you start cramming people one on top of the other and you empower a handful of people and you give them all these, you know, not only do you give them the power, but you also give them the task of maintaining things. You've created a lot of tension there.
Yes, I think as you move from high density, high rise, if you will, condominium structures down through the different housing types to townhouse style that are a little more spread out to single family homes detached that still are within a community, the need for regulation falls away a little bit so that you don't need as many rules as you would in a condominium with an estate of big homes with big yards that are all independent. But there, if, as long as there's common areas to maintain and repair, you've got to have income, and you have to have an understanding in advance as to the level of maintenance that you're going to do there so that everybody is on the same page. And I think where you get into the most trouble is where you're imposing behavioral rules on people.
Right, right.
And which may be more justified in higher density situations and less justified in lower density ones. And I think people's perception of what's justified or not varies a lot. But I do think that the need for behavioral rules falls away a lot as you move from high density into low density situations.
I went to Syria a while back, and I noticed there was a whole lot of construction, huge, huge, huge houses. And I started talking to the people there, and I said, you know, they were not the high, nothing is grotesque as the pictures you have on your website. These were really very nice buildings with, I don't know, 12, 15, 18 houses, apartments, a few stories high, beautifully built, immaculately maintained. And so I asked them, I said, how does it work? What happens? And apparently they buy, you know, they go in together and they buy the building, but there's no legal structure, there's no legal framework. They each own their own unit. The downstairs units own the gardens. And if anything needs to be, and they all share in maintaining the common areas. I mean, you've got stairwells and things like that. And they've worked out a system where either they or, you know, they hire someone to come in personally and maintain it, or maybe they'll split off and say, all right, I'll do it on the first and third Monday, and you do it on the second and sixth Wednesday, or what, you know, whatever. And they actually come to an agreement amongst themselves. I mean, talk about the New England style of the town hall meetings. And they decide, you know, do we want to add an elevator? Do we want to do this? And how, somebody will do some research and they'll say, yes, I found three, you know, I got three bids and this is what it will cost, and divide it. And they work it that way, Tyler.
Well, and that was, I'm sorry, I missed the country.
Syria.
Yeah. Well, you know, and there's a couple of things going on there. First of all, these were fairly new developments.
These were currently being built, yeah.
Well,
And older ones as well. I'm sorry. I talked to a lot of people. I said, I asked them how it worked because I was just fascinated. You know, people were calling each other and saying, hey, I'm making your favorite dish. Come on over and have some. It was a real community sense of feeling. I'm going, how do you guys do this?
Well, I think it's a little lesson in cultural differences, for one thing. I also know, at least in my experience, that owners in new communities, brand new or within a couple of years, have a greater sense of community spirit, if you want to call it, than those who live in older ones where things have begun to be problematic. A new community has the, you know, still has the sense of what the developer's theme was, and everybody's excited about being in this new development. I just think, I think there's a sense of community cooperation that exists in newer projects than older ones. But I do think, too, that you're seeing some cultural differences. Americans are notoriously undisciplined and independent, and have, believe that they have the right to express themselves independently. I think some cultures, I don't think all cultures are like that. I think there are a lot of cultures that have maybe older, you know, older societies who have more of a history of community involvement and community spirit and working together. I do think there's probably, and those cultural differences undoubtedly reflect also in their housing governance as well. I can see how what is essentially a tenancy in common, which is what you're describing, can function if you have the right attitude and the right, you know, cultural traditions among the owners that would allow them to cooperate and see the need to cooperate. We have a strong independent spirit like we have in the United States. It's not so easy.
So they have to be beaten into submission. Tanya, I talked to someone who grew up in one of these buildings, and her parents bought it, and she and her family grew up in there. And I asked them, one of the big concerns that we seem to have in America is the fact that people, if you were so loosey-goosey about everything, people wouldn't pay. Has that been a problem where somebody hasn't done their fair share? And in all the years, it was a problem once that she remembered. And, I mean, we're talking 40, 50 years that this woman has lived there. She says it's been a problem once, and that's when the owner was gone and the elderly mother was there and renting or living in the unit. And she didn't want to cooperate very much. But once the son came back and he took over, it was not a problem. It was not an issue. So there is cooperation. They do work together. Nobody has powers over the other. Nobody is given any authority that everybody else doesn't have, and they just worked it out together.
I think there's also a strong sense of honor in a lot of communities, like older and older cultures, that, and also where people have grown up in the same, literally the same building or within close proximity to each other, generations of people develop traditions of working together. Americans are very mobile, and they move around state to state, city to city. You're going to move into next door to people you don't know at all and have no history with at all. And I think that the mobility of our culture has a little to do with the lack of willingness to simply cooperate or no tradition of cooperation in the same way you're describing it.
It's funny, I interviewed Link Cummings some time ago because he was one of the three people who started CAI back a million years ago, it seems. And I asked him, I said, what were you thinking at the time? What was your reason for wanting to do this? And his response was, because Americans are so mobile and because Americans pick up and move all the time, there is no sense of community. And I wanted to develop a sense of community where people would cooperate together, where you had a smaller group. I guess it failed, huh?
Well, I respect and admire the goal there, and CAI has done a marvelous job of, and other organizations like CAI have done a marvelous job of trying to, assist and instill a sense of community and working together. But, I think that the mobility of Americans has conspired against that, and I really think that basic sense of let's all work together is not as pronounced here in this country, and and the rules become more important than the spirit of working together, and because you need the rules to enforce the sense of community that doesn't always already exist, and that's kind of a recipe for dissension.
Yet Americans are one of the most generous and giving people in the country, in the world. They always seem to manage to come together and work together to better something. Yet when it comes to their homes, there seems to be a disconnect here, Tyler, and I'm just thinking out loud as I talk to you.
I think there's a distinction between most forms of community behavior that we encounter and what happens with your own home. You know, the man's home's the castle, that old thing. And I just think that when you start dictating to people about how they can behave, behavioral rules are the most difficult to enforce and probably the least necessary in a lot of cases. But rules involving the care and maintenance of the structure, what you can do to the exterior of your structure, people begin to get very, very provincial about that, if you will. They're very much concerned with not being told what it is they can do and not do, and we have a tremendous amount of friction that develops over those kinds of things. The other area of a lot of friction is just simple economy. If you raise the assessments enough to do the repairs that the board feels is necessary, you're undoubtedly going to upset a lot of people who are living on fixed incomes or first-time buyers, don't have the income stream to raise these assessments sufficiently. I had a very lovely lady call me a year or so ago, and I actually wrote about that conversation in one of my publications. And she was a retired lady, a widow, and she lived in this association for 25 years. And the board wanted to raise her assessments by $150 a month. And she didn't have the money. She couldn't afford it. And she said, why would they do this to me? I can't afford this. I'm going to be out on the street. Yet the association was about 75% underfunded for the repair work that it had to do. And the board was in had a tremendous dilemma. Yes, do we raise these assessments and put some of these people out, who just don't have the economic ability to do this? Or do we let the project, do we defer the maintenance a little longer? It's a terrible dilemma.
What about, now the current economic situation is not contributing to the well-being of these associations, but what about where boards don't provide the adequate oversight, and you're hearing more and more of managers and board members just absconding with hundreds of thousands and millions of dollars of HOA money?
That particular problem hasn't been apparent here. Now, I've read of those things and I've heard of it, but I haven't seen it. And I haven't seen where, first of all, in California, for the most part, property managers are, they're not regulated in like stockbrokers, but they nevertheless, have reporting obligations. People keep an eye on the things they do. There are usually accountants who are outside of that group and who are keeping an eye on things. I have to tell you, I have not heard in California and where in our area of a lot of instances of that. I would think it would be very hard for a typical board member to even figure out how to do that, much less do it. But I do know that in some places that's true. And it may be that there's a different set of governance rules in other places that facilitate that. And if there is, then that has to be tightened up, no question.
Well, it's happening. I mean, it's happening here in Virginia. It was $3.8 million or something. And my association was one of the associations that was managed by this firm. So it does happen. And there was another story yesterday, I think, in the papers where you had a woman who'd embezzled over $100,000. They're varying amounts of dollars, but they add up to a significant money.
No question. And any amount of money taken unlawfully is wrong and shouldn't be. But you've got to examine the rules that have allowed someone to, I guess if you get enough people in on the conspiracy, anything's possible. No matter how many controls you have in place, if you have all those people involved in the conspiracy, then it's likely to happen. But the loss of funds that way is catastrophic. There's no question about it. But we're seeing loss of funds in other ways of simply not accumulating enough over time, so that when you get to the point where you need them, you're almost as much upside down as if somebody ran off with the money.
I know, and that's a big problem. Let's recap because we're running out of time. We've got a couple of minutes. Conversion's a big problem. You've got pictures on your website with a lot of buildings, of several buildings that really look like nightmares. And the problem is you don't have boards, you don't have adequate training, you don't have adequate reserves, you don't have adequate oversight. And so you think there's a chance that we may have to scrap this form of housing and go to something else?
Well, when they get to the point where they can no longer maintain them properly, so that basic habitability is in question. And I have some right now, and they're conversions, that literally are getting close to the point where they might not be able to pay the water bill, the garbage bill, that sort of thing. At that point, a city or county is going to have to look at them and look at the possibility of coming in and taking over. And they do that by means of condemnation, and they simply move the people out and property gets sold off. If it gets to the point where people can't live in these projects safely because there isn't enough money to do it, then the project's probably reached the end of its service life, which means a whole new type of development's going to have to be put there. But over time, the new ones, I think we need to look at some alternative ways to govern them that puts a little more mandatory fundraising ability in place, like property taxation, essentially, that so there's an income stream that whoever's doing the governing can count on, and is not so subject to the whim of a volunteer board and the individual economic needs of the owners, which vary tremendously from, as I said, from fixed income people to new buyers to people who are better, you know, are in better shape. But the volunteer system that we have now, I think is got some serious problems, and I wished I had a ready answer as to what we put in its place, but I'm not convinced that what we've got is going to last forever.
Do you think it's just the volunteer situation, or do you think that the fact that it's common ownership that's a problem, that's not working?
Well, if you're going to have high-density living, and I mean anything that's attached, two dwellings that are attached, two or more, you've got to have some sort of common rulemaking ability so that you can govern, because you can't maintain it. Anything you can't maintain separately by yourself, all completely yourself, you've got to have some kind of working agreement with the people you share the building with. And I think it's a lot of it has to do with trying to maintain these buildings with that kind of rulemaking, as opposed to, say, a landlord or a commercial owner of a building makes those decisions on his or her own and raises whatever money they need out by way of the rents and things like that. There may be that we've gone too far in the direction of home ownership for everyone when we've taken these old apartment buildings that weren't even adequate for Section 8, and we've turned around and sold them to the Section 8 tenants as homes. Now we've gone off the deep end.
Let's talk about that next time, Tyler.
Okay.
Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Sue.
Thank you for joining us today. Please check out our website at onthecommons.us. On the Commons is produced by OTC Multimedia Productions.
Well, I finally bought my dream home to enjoy retirement life. I've made new friends and buddies, lots of parties for my wife. It seemed that life was perfect, all my neighbors felt the same. Then along came death by CCRs, life's over, I'm fair game. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Now there's lots of open meetings close to Justice 4HO. Those arrogant board members say what they want you to know. The CAI and ULI will help you lose it all. But I wouldn't sell that dream home yet, the writing's on the wall. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Well, we're not afraid or stupid, all your threats mean nothing here. Time marches on, soon you'll be gone, united we'll be there. So put your rules and CCRs up where the sun don't shine, and enjoy those precious golden years, stop messing around with mine. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell.